College students are struggling to find Christ in a culture that rejects God. They need the Christmas message of hope and truth now more than ever. Thanks to a generous matching gift, every dollar you give to the Thomistic Institute before December 31st will be doubled, so your gift will touch twice as many souls. You can give the greatest of all gifts by sending the light of Christ to students aching for truth. Please use the link below or go to thomisticinstitute.org/donate to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Friendship and the Digital Age, a Thomistic Reflection on Human Connection. In fall 2008, when many current college students, many of you, were 4, 3, 2, or maybe even only 1 year old, I taught a class called Love and Friendship. It was a 400-level philosophy class, and the course description read in part, "From Plato to John Paul II, love has been considered one of the most significant themes of philosophical reflection. Linked to the concerns of ethics, the nature of the human person, politics, and theology, evoking our basest passions and highest aspirations, perhaps no theme is more central to the human condition." The readings included texts from classical and modern authors, philosophers, theologians, and novelists, and it attracted college students and seminarians. Conversations in class were spirited, challenging, and most of all, fun. Fittingly, it was one of those classes that feels like a little community. By every measure, it was a success, and I still hear from students about how much they valued the experience in that class. In the spring of 2017, I had a chance to teach the class again. And given the success of the first time, you might think that I wouldn't make any changes. But I decided to modify the reading list and frame the course a little differently. The new course description included the following. Distraction and loneliness seem to be marks of modern Western life. Friendship and contemplation have long been thought to be essential human goods, but modern technology and culture present particular challenges to the experience of these goods. This class will draw on classical and contemporary sources to reflect on human nature and its orientation towards truth and personal relationship. In keeping with this new description, the class title also changed from Love and Friendship to Friendship and Contemplation in the Digital Age. The new title reflected two elements that were not so central to the previous course. First, contemplation, the intellect's turning to noble truths. And second, implicit challenges to both friendship and contemplation, the digital age. What had happened in the 8.5 years since I had previously taught the course? Given the turnover of an undergraduate population every 4 years, that is functionally 2 full generations of college students later, like the distance between grandparents and grandchildren. Historically, that has not meant much of a change in higher education, but during that time, a remarkable new piece of technology was starting to transform culture, including the culture of college. And you probably know what I mean. The iPhone was released in 2007. In the time between the two courses, it had gone from a novelty to a commonplace. College students in 2008 grew up without smartphones, and social media was in its infancy. By 2017, digital portable personal technology was changing the habits of its users, including of my students, and that means changing relations and experience, the whole social psychological landscape of choice. Today, we are 2 more full generations of college students later, from 2017 to 2025. You all likely take smartphones entirely for granted and don't remember life without constant digital connectivity. Many of you might have had your own iPhone already in 6th or 7th grade. Am I right, some of you? That still blows my mind. By contrast, in 2008, probably none of my students had smartphones, and by 2017, while most of them did, they could all remember life without them. Today, you not only take smartphones for granted, you take for granted that they are a mixed blessing. In 2017, many things that are now common knowledge were only beginning to be recognized, that smartphones and social media are designed to be addictive, that they are associated with increased anxiety and depression, that they make it harder to concentrate, focus, and offer personal attention, that they pose threats to children's intellectual and moral development. 2017 was also the year that I published with a friend a book called A Mind at Peace, Reclaiming an Ordered Soul in the Age of Distraction, partly informed by that teaching experience. One goal of that book was to help people think about the psychological effects of technology specifically as moral and spiritual challenges. There had already been a lot of research into how digital technology, especially the internet, portable digital devices, and social media, were changing human experience, habits, and relationships. This had been studied and continues to be studied by sociologists, psychologists, political theorists, neuroscientists. Indeed, just about every discipline has noticed and given some attention to how digital media is shaping human lives. But it seemed to us that it was important to approach this from a different framework, the classical understanding of the human soul. My co-author and I thought the technology was threatening and described some of the threats that are now widely recognized. But we also saw in digital technology a kind of opportunity and even a blessing. It helped to focus attention on some basic truths about human nature, our longing for truth and our longing for friendship, and implicitly the connection between these two longings, our rational and our social nature being one and the same. I believe that it is especially important for students to reflect on their choices about technology and how those choices form habits and shape their souls. Colleges and universities are crucial sites of social and intellectual formation, and it should be part of any worthy education to reflect on friendship, the pursuit of truth, and how they are related. Especially here, for an evening gathered named after John Henry Newman. This is a Newman night. What do you call it? Newman evening? After John Henry Newman, who was recently named a doctor of the church, for a lecture sponsored under the auspices of the Thomistic Institute and physically connected to a Dominican parish at a university which still has a motto from John 8:32. You knew that, right? Veritatis vos liberavit, the truth will set you free. Especially here, we should feel encouraged to explore the relationship between fellowship and truth. I'm sure you know the common iconography for St. Thomas, with an image of the sun on his chest. The sun is a classic and fitting image of intellectual illumination, clarity, and vision. But it is also an image of warmth and of purity. And the placement of the sun on Thomas's chest reminds us that the pursuit of truth is not only intellectual, but a matter of the heart. Thomas was a lover of truth. The Dominican theologian Yves Congar described St. Thomas as a servant of the truth and said that the true and living root of this service was love and a mutual relationship with love. Likewise, St. John Henry Newman's personal and episcopal motto reminds us that he counted the communication of wisdom as nothing without love. Cor ad cor loquitur, heart speaks to heart. At risk of sounding pretentious or portentous, but in the spirit of Doctors Thomas and Newman, and even of John the Evangelist, I offer this lecture as an act of service to the truth. Presuming that you too care about the truth, especially truth about yourself, I offer it as an act of friendship, an invitation for us to pursue human goods together. The main body of the lecture will make three, I hope, easy to understand points, all meant to help you think about modern technology as presenting a spiritual challenge, a challenge to the discipline of your hearts and minds and relationships. First will be a point about technology in general and its propensity to shape us. The second point is about what makes digital technology, especially the smartphone, particularly distinctive and dangerous in the way that it shapes us. And finally, I will focus on two particular vices that digital technology tempts us to develop. While throughout I will speak in terms of threats and dangers of technology, my overall message is actually optimistic. I am not anti-technological. I carry a smartphone and I use social media. You can follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter. I sincerely believe that thoughtfully coming to terms with the spiritual challenges of digital media gives us reason to hope. But that hope is rooted in a conviction that human beings seek understanding together, that truth and friendship are goods that our souls long for and desire. So I will be sure to include at the conclusion of the lecture some practical advice about meeting the challenge of seeking fulfillment in friendship and truth in the environment of modern technology. So the first main section is called Technology and Agency. We tend to think of technology as something that magnifies our agency, our power to act. We imagine a piece of technology as a tool that increases our capacity, that makes us stronger agents, makes it possible for us to do something we hadn't been able to do before, or to do things faster or more efficiently, or at larger scale than we had done before. We tend to think of technology as magnifying or leveraging our agency so that it has more precise or pronounced or extensive scope. But there's another common observation that goes at least as far back as Plato in ancient Greece, that technology has a tendency to hide our agency from us, to obscure the sense in which we are responsible choice-making agents. Technology, especially very powerful technology, tends to reorganize the way human beings relate to their activity and to each other. So while it might make it easier to make some kinds of choices, it can also make it harder to make other kinds of choices, or even to notice that we are making choices at all. A very common example is how life during the 20th century changed under the influence of the automobile. The very first people to own automobiles no doubt felt more powerful. They could go faster and farther, get to places that were previously hard to reach in reasonable time by foot or by horseback. I got here in just over an hour, and it took Mother Seton, you know, a couple days to travel this far. So the car was experienced originally as something that increased power and heightened people's sense of agency. But as automobiles became more common, and as more and more people had access to them, and their power became more widely distributed, this new technology stopped being experienced as something that only increased power, and it started to feel like something that we depend on, even that we are sometimes enslaved to and can't live without. In many places in the world today, it is very difficult to live without a car. Those who manage to live without a car are likely in a city with good transit and walkable neighborhoods, the kind of place that has become somewhat rare and is even considered something of a luxury. This is not to say that cars are evil or that they have had a net negative impact on society. It is only to acknowledge that there is a cost to the integration of such a powerful new technology into society. It did not only come with benefits. There were losses along with the gains. Cars changed the way we build our environment, the way we relate to each other, our expectations of what people can and should do. We now find ourselves in a position where the technology is so powerful, it is experienced as itself a cultural agent that acts on us, so that we are not actively controlling a tool, but passively receiving a cultural force, as if we are patients or even victims of a technology. As I mentioned, Plato observed this long ago. He wrote that there was a psychosocial cost to the invention of writing. Writing is a technology, a human invention, to record thoughts and speech in symbols. And of course, most of us involved in education would not want to live without that technology, and we want to teach students how to use that technology well. Writing is an incredible blessing. But Plato's reflection was that with the invention of writing, a particular power of the human mind began to weaken and atrophy, the power of memory. Presumably, before the invention of writing, if people wanted to retain knowledge of something, they had to remember it. They couldn't count on finding it written down somewhere in the future. Still, for a long time, even until today, school exercises to memorize things like historical dates, political leaders, and capital cities have persisted. But now many teachers are willing to do away with these exercises on the assumption that students don't need to memorize history or politics or geography. They can always look it up As Google prevails, memory fails. Search engines are powerful, and I use them as much as anyone. But I'm sure that because of that, my own memory has atrophied, and I don't retain as much because I don't need to. Plato saw the same with the very invention of writing. In general, when a new technology is so powerful that we use it to do new things, it reshapes our expectations, relationships, and the kinds of choices we make. Whenever a technology is powerful enough to do that, there is some kind of cost. There are exercises and habits we once depended on that are no longer developed, social practices and virtues that come to be ignored or replaced by new cultural patterns. Often we don't even notice that this is happening, that we have been making choices to live one way rather than another. Instead, if we notice a change at all, we see ourselves as passively brought along to a different way of life, rather than as making a responsible decision. That is an authentic feeling, as if we are just being carried by the current of history. But we do have a choice. We are agents, we have responsibility for how we integrate technology into our lives, and we have to take responsibility for those choices, even if we feel there are pressures to make some choices rather than others. Digital technology has not only changed our habits of seeking information, it has changed our habits of how we communicate with other people and how we experience community. One of the lessons of classical reflection on friendship is that it is not merely a feeling of affection or a desire for unity. It is participation in shared activity. We are capable of friendship to the extent that we are capable of joining with others in pursuit of a common good. Thus, any technology that not only changes how we experience relationship, but that hides our sense of agency and responsibility for achieving common cause, will have the effect of making friendship harder to achieve. I will take a very basic example. One of the reasons we are drawn to texting or similar modes of communication is that it gives us the feeling of control, while it actually requires less agency from us. By texting, we can quickly express a thought or a question without committing to the unpredictable and complicated work of true conversation. By comparison, consider how much investment of effort and attention it takes to make a simple phone call. When the other person picks up, you utter a greeting, perhaps an apology for interruption, some polite small talk or acknowledgement of a previous conversation, listening carefully to the tone of voice to evaluate the interlocutor's mood and receptiveness to whatever it is you might want to discuss. All of this before the substance of the phone conversation actually begins. Such work, such concentration of attention and emotional attunement, such dynamic responsiveness and range of activity, we can avoid all that by sending a text or an email. For some, that work does not feel like a burden, but one must be socialized into such work, as your own likely aversion to phone calls, the perception that they are a relic of boomer culture, no doubt attests. Is that fair? Am I being unfair? You don't like phone calls, right? Still, you recognize, don't you, that it's nice that grandma wants to talk on the phone sometimes, and that there are certain kinds of conversations that at least need the personal touch of a voice, if not the presence of face-to-face. There are, of course, times and places where simply exchanging information is adequate. Perhaps it is unnecessary to call a friend to tell her you are running 10 minutes late, if a text will do. On the other hand, sometimes a phone call might be better in such situations. And if you find that you almost always communicate by text, is it possible that that implies something about the quality of the relationship and your willingness to invest in it? I'm not saying that all texting is bad. I'm simply pointing out a plain truth about human nature and human weakness. The fact that we are so easily tempted to text and no longer required to invest in more challenging modes of interpersonal communication means that our environment invites us to avoid certain basic modes of cooperative activity, with the accompanying experience of various dimensions of invested sharing. Hence the irony that technologies of communication and social media can leave people feeling isolated, alienated, and alone. That technologies purported to connect us actually make the experience of friendship increasingly elusive. Part 2 is called Distraction by Design. My first point about technology in general was that it was as likely to weaken as to strengthen our sense of agency, and so also to weaken our experience of goods like friendship that depend on agency. The second point I want to make is that digital technology doesn't merely happen to, but is very, very deliberately designed to hide or weaken our sense of agency and to isolate us from others. It does this, by the way, it appeals to our exterior and interior senses. That digital technology appears to our exterior senses is obvious. Bright, colorful screens that attract our attention, our eyes are drawn to these, loving the stimulus of motion and color and brightness. The physical devices we carry in our pockets are designed to capture our attention, and the designers of the operating systems even make it difficult to switch the display from color to black and white because they know it would not be as appealing, as captivating, as irresistible to our attention. Have you ever tried this? It's hard. It's hard. You can do it, but they hide the switch for that. If you haven't ever switched your phone to grayscale, it's a good experiment. First, to notice how difficult it is to do, and second, to see how it changes your experience of the phone and its hold on your attention. If you don't want to go grayscale all the time, it at least makes a good practice of detachment during penitential seasons. Not only the physical device with its beautiful screen and comfortable feel in the hand, but all of its software is designed to attract your attention. It was not as widely known when I was teaching and writing in 2017, but by now it is fairly common knowledge. Social media companies, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, all the rest, they all use highly sophisticated algorithms designed to attract, grab, and hold your attention. Every one of these companies has employed expert psychologists and neuroscientists to teach them how to engineer addiction, literally. The apps are specifically designed to be addictive. And that isn't a metaphor, it's not an exaggeration, it is a literal fact. Social media apps are carefully calibrated to give you bits of positive feedback and reinforcement, doling out doses of dopamine, training your brain to want more and to keep coming back. Some of you right now are resisting the temptation to check your phones because you're thinking like an ad, I could quit anytime. It is often said that if the product is free, then the user is the product. The user of the product is actually the product. Social media companies are learning about you. They're analyzing your behavior because that information is valuable. They do this in a very sophisticated way, and it is not facts or data that they care about so much as your behavior and your habits. They are learning about in order to manipulate and shape your habits of attention. The physical device is so well designed to attract the physical senses, especially the eye, but also the ear, because these are gateways to our interior senses. By interior senses, I mean first our imagination. Digital media shapes the way we internally visualize and experience the world. The interior senses also include memory, not only images, but also stories and connections we make about who we are and the way the world is. And there is what Aquinas calls the estimative sense, how we categorize things and what we think of as true and false, what we take to be plausible or implausible, what seems genuinely real. Our use of smartphones shapes all of these senses, but most of all, it shapes our attention. Attention is the way that our consciousness is directed to objects. Since there is so much we could pay attention to, a lot of attention involves filtering things out, ignoring some things to focus on others. Right now, sitting in the hall, listening to me, your five senses are bringing into your body all kinds of sense objects, smells and tastes, images in your peripheral vision, or even irrelevant aspects of visual images in your field of focus. Background noises, these are all coming into you, and your brain is working to make sure that you don't pay attention to them so that you can focus, I hope, on the meaning of the words that you hear. So evidently, the task of paying attention requires discipline and well-developed habits. One must work at developing the power of attention. Some of the work takes place subconsciously or unconsciously, but it is still trained, like the reflexes and muscle memory of an athlete. And some of it is subject to the exercise of the conscious and deliberate will. One of the things we do as rational agents is choose what to pay attention to. And sometimes we have to work harder at that than others, being intentional about what things we will ignore, For example, if there is distracting music in a store or a baby crying at Mass, priests get really good at ignoring things. You have to choose what and how you will pay attention. Attention is key to our sense of ourselves as agents, our sense of who we are and what it is in our power to do. Our attention provides our sense of what it is before us, what is before us as actionable options. This is why social media companies are so committed to shaping and keeping your attention. Now, here is a dramatic analogy. The efforts of social media to shape your attention are like the insidious work that has classically been attributed to tempting demons. C.S. Lewis's book, The Screwtape Letters, describes temptation well. Lewis imagined written advice from a senior demon to a junior demon about how to get someone to fall into sin. There is a humorous dimension to this fiction, but it is spiritually very serious. Lewis was drawing on Aquinas' understanding of temptation in the interior life, and he makes a very important point. Demonic temptation doesn't work by instruction. Demons don't try to teach, and they don't insist on a doctrine. They don't even want to be objects of your awareness. Demons work indirectly, and their aim is to divert your attention. They remain hidden, and they don't so much want you to know something as to keep you from knowing something, and to distract your will from caring about the things you should care about. So Lewis describes the demons not as agents of instruction, but as agents of distraction. Distraction is the key to all spiritual temptation. A few years ago, I reread Lewis's book right before watching the 2020 Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, about how social media companies try to manipulate our attention. And the parallel was unmistakable. I'm not saying that social media companies are deliberately malicious or that they are explicitly demonic, but for whatever reason, they have sought to do through technology the same thing that classically understood tempting demons do, to distract us from the things we should know and care about for their own purposes. The perversity of this is no longer so hidden. Mark Zuckerberg used to describe his goal as using technology to enhance personal relationships, but recently he has been starkly honest about using technology to replace personal relationship. It was bad enough that the notion of friend became watered down to simply mean an online connection. But generative AI, which can mimic conversation, offers a very tempting simulacrum of friendship. Friend.com markets, literally and without irony, an AI necklace that accompanies you and talks to you as a friend. Not only is it not a real friend, it is an excuse not to have a real friend. Given human nature, many people will be tempted to have one. But if you stop and think about it, can you see how depressing, how dehumanizing, how demonic that temptation is? At the same time, technology is making it easier for us to forget what it means to take responsibility for our choices. It is increasingly trying to engineer artificial replacements for authentic human relationship. So the third main part of the talk is called Two Vices of Distraction. So far, I've discussed technology's tendency to hide our sense of agency and described how digital technology is especially designed to hide our agency by distracting our interior senses. In both respects, technology threatens not only our sense of self, but our sense of relationship and the possibility of recognizing and experiencing common action or friendship with others. It is good to be able to name these threats and to describe them with precision. So now I will describe two particular vices that digital technology tends to encourage and foster. I think it is good to conceptualize these vices, to have a vocabulary for them, so that we can recognize them and be more aware of how they may be at work in our lives and the lives of those around us. Knowing and naming these vices is the first step towards fortifying ourselves against them. The first vice is called, in Latin, curiositas. This is not curiosity in the common English sense, which is thought to be neutral or even benevolent, a kind of wonder or interest in things. Teachers often say that we want students to have curiosity, meaning a general desire to know. In Latin, curiositas is a specifically disordered desire to know. It is the vice that Augustine describes having in the Confessions, when instead of being diligent and attending to important things, he was distracted by gossip, by spectacle, and by the desire for recognition. We all have some desire to know, some direction that our intellect wants to go, but that desire can be well disciplined and ordered and directed to the things the intellect should know, or it can be disordered and misdirected. It can wander. Curiositas is the vice associated by Dante with Odysseus, the wanderer, in Canto 26 of Inferno. Odysseus's wandering was not overtly malicious, and after all, it is part of what led to the exciting heroic adventures that make his story worthwhile. But his journey is a struggle. He was supposed to be headed home, yet he found himself distracted by various things that led him astray, diverted his energies, and held him back from his proper purpose. To avoid the vice of curiositas, the complementary virtue one needs is called, again in Latin, studiositas. English studiosity or studiousness are poor translations. They are typically associated with being disciplined or diligent in school. But more broadly, studiositas applies beyond academic contexts outside of the environment of books and exams. Studiositas means a kind of ordered, directed capacity to pay attention to the right things. It is seeking what should be known in the way that it should be known. This is a very important virtue for us to cultivate when we are in an environment full of distractions, constantly telling us to give attention to things that are not important or not in any way ordered to our well-being. The second vice that is especially relevant to our interior senses is the parent vice of curiositas. Aquinas puts daughter vices under seven main parent or capital vices, and curiositas is a daughter of the capital vice of acedia. Acedia is usually translated in English as sloth and is sometimes associated with laziness, boredom, and a depressed mood. But it doesn't only mean these things. More generally, it is a failure to love well, a departure of the will from its proper object. One sign of acedia is a kind of restless activity, someone procrastinating by finding new tasks to do, distracting herself from important work. A frenzy of activity or a binge of cleaning may not seem slothful, but this can be a form of acedia. Acedia doesn't mean lack of activity, it means a weakening of the love for good and worthy activity. It is the inability to pursue the good that ought to be pursued here and now. So while it can be manifested as something like lack of willpower altogether, what we typically think of as sloth, it also manifests itself as a kind of frenetic avoidance of one activity by indulging in some other distracting activity. Acedia is what leads to binge watching and doom scrolling. Aquinas says that acedia can cause curiositas. The vice of a misdirected will can be made concrete in the particular vice of a misdirected will to know. He does not say, but I think it is plausible to assume, indeed it seems to be revealed to us under the influence of digital technology, that the causality can work in the other direction. Curiositas can cause acedia. The fact that we are distracted and give attention to things to which we shouldn't give attention has the effect, over time, of weakening our will to do what is good and to know what is right. That would be the spiritual way of framing what psychologists have documented, that one of the most commonly reported effects of addiction to smartphones is anxiety and depression. Many of us know this anecdotally. As perhaps we've seen in our friends or family or experienced ourselves, it is now widely recognized that people who find themselves spending too much time on digital media end up feeling mentally dissipated. Depression and anxiety are rising at surprising rates among young people in a very close correlation with increased use of smartphones. Culturally, we have seen a massive change in how people have cultivated and shaped their attention. I have already described the dramatic technological changes in the lifetime of current undergraduates, which is, by any accounting, an unprecedented mass sociological experiment. And you are the guinea pigs, and we still don't know how this will affect your interior lives, the virtues and vices that you cultivate, your sense of who you are in the world, and your sense of meaningful agency. It is important at the very least that we talk about this in terms that help us make sense of it. Better than secular psychological terms, which lead some people to think that the problems can be medicated away or otherwise solved with further technology, I think it is helpful to draw on the wisdom of classical philosophy and Christian theology. The concepts of virtue and vice, and especially the notions of curiositas, studiositas, and asadia, are some valuable tools to make sense of what our culture is experiencing. And these terms are especially relevant to friendship. In classical terms, friendship has sometimes been characterized as willing the good of another. I think this is inadequate. Friendship would be better characterized as knowing and joining the life of another. A key notion Aristotle uses in developing his notion of friendship is homonoia, literally same-mindedness. And Cicero uses a similar word in Latin, consensio, cognate with English consensus. Both words are commonly translated as concord, but this is misleading too. It suggests either a consensus primarily in knowledge, intellectual agreement or mutual understanding, or perhaps also a kind of emotional harmony, sympathy, or fellow feeling. But neither suffices. Homonoia and consensio signify more than a concord of mind and emotion. They signify a concord of action. A reasonable loose translation could be common cause or even solidarity. As Aristotle says, homonoia is more than sharing a belief. A city, he says, is said to be in concord when its citizens agree about what is advantageous, make the same decision, and act on their common resolution. When multiple people are in concord, they have shared stakes where decisions are pursued together and their consequences are borne together. Friendship involves this kind of common action, shared consciousness, and practical solidarity. This requires all the virtues, but it especially requires virtues of attention and ordered will. One must be aware of what is most fundamental and important. One must take stock of present opportunities for action, and one must relate the latter to the former to coordinate one's choices with the choices of others. Only people capable of such attention, discernment, and judgment are capable of friendship. And so, to the conclusion, reasons for hope and practical advice. In this lecture, I have made three main points. First, technology in general is as likely to hide our sense of agency as to magnify it. Second, digital technology is very specifically designed to distract and manipulate our interior senses, especially our attention. And third, we can identify specific vices that are particularly at stake in the modern technological assault on our attention. Curiositas, disordered attention, and asadia, a failure of the will to pursue the good in personal and social contexts. All of these have dire consequences for our sense of self and our ability to perceive ourselves as offering and receiving friendship in common life with others. It may seem that the overall tone of the lecture has been pessimistic, yet I really see the challenge of digital media as an occasion of hopefulness. There is a wonderful opportunity for a new level of awareness, for sparking a new noticing of our weaknesses and the need for thoughtfulness about our interior lives. This is an opportunity for spiritual and intellectual awakening and an openness to reflection about human nature and human fulfillment. So what might otherwise be only a threat, the transformation of our experience of attention and its habits under the influence of digital technology, I also see as an opportunity for renewal and a great source of hope. In particular, I think it is helpful to focus on what it means to be a friend, that is, the kind of person who is not only capable of making good choices for him or herself, but making good choices for and with others in common cause. How can you do this? I will offer three pieces of advice. First, cultivate the virtues. Virtues don't only strengthen your own agency, they make you worthy of friendship with others. This means attending especially to the basic virtues, the cardinal virtues of temperance and courage, justice and prudence. And it especially means attending to the key virtue of a friend, trustworthiness. Be the kind of person that others know they can rely on. Classical reflections on friendship give special attention to issues of integrity, loyalty, and truthfulness. Any lack in these areas can damage friendship, sometimes permanently. You would not tolerate unreliability or betrayal or deception or hypocrisy in a friend, so work yourself on being the kind of person known for being steadfast, dependable, and trustworthy. There is great reward and peace in becoming someone of responsibility and integrity. Second, take honest stock of how you use your leisure time or your downtime. Your use of such freedom is a sure sign of what you think is truly important, and it orients everything else, including work and family obligations. When no external demands are placed on it, is your attention occupied with things that build you up and orient you towards things beautiful and noble and true? Or do you allow it to be distracted, indulged, and dulled? Your attention is a kind of appetite. How are you feeding it, directing it, and disciplining it? Review especially what you give attention to in spare moments. How do you handle boredom's temptation to seek distracting relief? Do you stay mindful of important things, read a worthy book, attend to the people who mean most to you? Or do you slip into gossip, cultivate envy, seek approval, or worry about status and reputation? It does not take extraordinary effort, but it can have an extraordinary effect on ordering your attention to go for a walk, to read a book, or have a genuine conversation with a friend. Today's common advice for the terminally online, touch grass, evokes some basic classical wisdom about taking responsibility for one's attention. Third, and as a help to those first two, become more conscious of your given community. We might think that common cause with others typically exists only by consent, made by deliberate choice, but this is a secondary sense of belonging and the exception, not the rule. Our most important senses of belonging to community are received as gifts. The belonging of parents and children to each other, of husband and wife to each other, of neighbor with neighbor, of student and teacher, of citizen with homeland, none of these, in the normal course of events, are entirely chosen. We do not make, we discover our membership and calling. Where choice comes in, it is in accepting and humbly receiving a gift of circumstances, perhaps providential circumstances, beyond our power. Modern circumstances often lead us to think of community and common life as always chosen and contrived, a matter of one's own making. We are seldom aware of inheriting a community or receiving a role with given duties and responsibilities. Or maybe we are, but we have been habituated out of noticing. Young people today are often told to follow their passions or to make meaning through their choices. But every college student already occupies a life of given belonging to others, a special state in life, a vocation to study, reinforced by the blessings of a structured leisure, where for a privileged period of time, immediate servile concerns are taken care of so that attention can be turned to more liberal matters, the cultivation of the mind. College is an especially blessed time, because friendship is partly constituted by the shared exploration of what it means to be friends, which is to say the shared pursuit of what it means to be virtuous, to attend to important things, to live as best you can in your given situation in common with others. That should be evident every day on a campus of higher education, but let's say especially here, under the auspices of doctors of the church like Saints Newman and Thomas, in an environment conscious of the relationship between truth and friendship, including friendship with God. If you are blessed to be a member of this community, give thanks and attend to the opportunities you have to receive and carry on its legacy, pursuing common cause with fellow members. A university is a promise of friendship in pursuit of truth. If you find yourself included in that promise, embrace it as part of your sense of self, and you will find yourself in authentic and worthy friendship, pursuing with others the truth of who you are and of what will fulfill you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.